This is lecture one of a lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Initiate Consciousness, Truth and Error in Spiritual Research. It's a cycle of lectures, delivered August 11th through the 22nd in 1924 at Torquay, England. It is, in fact, the last lecture cycle Rudolf Steiner ever gave abroad. Lecture one is entitled, Nature is the Great Illusion, Know Thyself. Why do we seek at all for something spiritual? The wish has been expressed that I should speak in these lectures about the paths into the supersensible world, into the life of the spirit, paths which lead to supersensible knowledge, and which may be united with paths by which men have advanced in modern times in such great and beautiful ways to a knowledge of the physical world, the world of the senses. For only that man can arrive at reality who, to all the admirable knowledge afforded in our day by natural science and historical science, and other kinds of knowledge, unites also what can be known about the spiritual world. Wherever the outer world meets us, it is, in very truth, both spiritual and physical. Nowhere is there anything physical which has not behind it something spiritual as the real activator. Nowhere is there anything spiritual that leads an existence void of real being and action, merely idling the time away in the world. On the contrary, everything spiritual to be found anywhere becomes active at some time and in some place, even into the physical sphere. It will be explained in the course of these lectures how the world in which man lives may be known by him as a totality, on the one hand as he lives within the realm of physical fact, and on the other hand, through the perception of a spiritual realm. And this will be explained in such a way that the true and the false methods of attaining such knowledge will be made clear. Before I come to my actual subject, with which I shall begin tomorrow, I should like today to give you a sort of introduction that you may know what to expect from these lectures, what is their purpose. The first task will be to bring home to us the question, why do we search at all for something spiritual? Why do we not content ourselves as human beings who think in the world, feel in the world, act in the world? Why do we not simply content ourselves with a comprehension of the physical sense world as it is, and with activity within it? Why do we strive after a knowledge of something spiritual? I venture in this connection to bring you to your attention an ancient conception, an ancient saying, but one containing an ever-expanding truth. A saying which echoes down to us out of the primeval thoughts and aspirations of humanity, but which we discover today also when we seek to learn the real being of the world. Although not the least element here is to be based upon ancient and strange conceptions, yet I should wish, wherever this is in order, to refer you to such conceptions of antiquity. Out of the East, echoing to us across thousands of years, resounds this saying, the world is Maya, this world which our senses perceive. The world we perceive with our senses is the great illusion, for Maya means the great illusion. And if this world, so men have always felt in the course of human evolution, if this world is the great illusion, then man must pass beyond this great illusion to genuine reality. But why did men think of this world, which they could see with their eyes, hear with their ears, and perceive with their other senses, as the great illusion? Why did mystery places come into existence in the most ancient times, the very times when man stood nearer to the spirit? Those places which existed for the fostering of science, religion, art, and the practical life, and which were designed to point to reality, to truth, in contradistinction to that which represented in the merely external life, the great illusion in which man at first lives in his ordinary activities. Why those outstanding sages who educated their disciples in the sacred mysteries of ancient times, who would lead them to truth as opposed to illusion? Why all this? Indeed, this question can be answered only when one's consideration of man himself becomes somewhat freer from prejudice and preconceptions. Know thyself. So resounds to us another ancient saying, and I might say that the whole aspiration of modern man to attain the spiritual knowledge arose from the fusion of these two sayings, The world is Maya from the Orient, and know thyself out of ancient Greek wisdom. But even in the most ancient mysteries, the striving for actual truth had its origin in this twofold perception, that the world is really illusion, and that man must attain to knowledge of himself. It is, however, only through life itself that man can come to an understanding of this question, not through his thinking, but through the will alone, and through a complete identification of himself with that reality most immediately accessible to us human beings. Neither in full consciousness nor in clear knowledge, but by means of intense feeling, every man, on whatever part of the earth he may be, says to himself, "Such as the outer world is which thou seest and hearest, that thou thyself canst not be." This is a profound experience. We must once for all make clear to our minds what this means when man says to himself, "Such as the outer world is, which thou seest, which thou hearest, which thou perceivest with thy other senses, that thou canst not be." We look at the plants. We see them come forth in spring with their young sprouts out of the roots. We see them unfold into blossoms in summer and toward autumn as fruit. We see them come into being and pass away. We see their life enclosed within the span of a year. We see, to be sure, that some plants draw a hardening element, if I may so express it, from the earth, permeate themselves with this, and build themselves tree trunks. While we were driving here yesterday evening by automobile in order to arrive quickly, we saw on the way old plants that had taken up a great deal of this earthy element, in order that their lives should not be compassed by 1 year, but that they might continue to live longer and bring forth ever new limbs on their trunks. Yet man has the opportunity to observe such plants as these, also coming into existence and passing away. Man sees the animals. He sees them come into existence and pass away. Finally, he does the same thing with the minerals. He observes what has been deposited in the earth in the form of minerals, in grand and mighty mountain ranges. In modern science, he has come to know that even these grand mountain ranges come into existence and pass away. At last, man turns to the conception, whether Ptolemaic or Copernican, or derived from one or another of the ancient or the modern mysteries, man comes to this conception. What thou beholdest in the majestic stars, what shines upon thee from sun and moon with all their marvelous and intricate orbits, all this likewise comes into existence and passes away. And besides this attribute of coming into existence and passing away, all this bears other attributes of such a nature that, if man is to know himself, he must not ascribe to himself a likeness to all that comes into existence and passes away, to plants, minerals, sun, moon, and stars. But man then comes to the conception, I bear within myself something that is unlike what I see in my environment, what I hear in my environment. I must attain to the truth of my own being. This I do not find in what I see and hear. In all the ancient mysteries, there was this craving to attain to the truth of the human being. In contrast with this truth of the human being that men sought, what comes into existence and passes away in the external space was felt to be the great illusion. And so, in order to know the human being, something was sought other than what is revealed by the outer senses. This other was felt to be a spiritual world. How this spiritual world may rightly be sought is to be the subject of these lectures. For you can readily see that a man will at first wish to extend further the path he has been accustomed to use in investigating the sense world. He will endeavor to continue for research in the spiritual world the very same method by which he has sought for the nature of the outer world. But if research in the sense world yields only illusions in ordinary life, one may expect that the illusion will not diminish but will increase if one chooses for attaining knowledge in the spiritual world the same path chosen for knowledge of the sense world. And indeed, it is just so. This will become clear to us. If we investigate in the spiritual world as we investigate in the sense world, the illusion cannot diminish but must increase, and we become involved in an ever greater and stronger illusion as we continue sense research into the spiritual sphere. And again, if we have intimations of the spiritual, if we have intimations vaguely in a dim mysticism, dream of the spiritual, then the spiritual certainly remains unknown to us. We merely have intimations of it. We merely believe. We know nothing of it. When we propose simply to continue this mysticism, this belief, these intimations in the presence of the spiritual world, it will become not better known to us, but ever more completely unknown. Footnote, the German word Ahnung is translated intimation in the sense of Wordsworth's, quote, intimations of immortality from recollections of early childhood, end quote, end footnote. Thus man may find, so to speak, two false ways. On the one hand, he conducts himself toward the spiritual world as toward the sense world. The sense world at first yields him illusion. If he seeks to extend the same path into the spiritual world as ordinary spiritualists do, he arrives not at a lesser, but at a greater illusion. And there is the other way, not to wish to penetrate into the spiritual world with thoroughgoing and clear research, but to believe, to have mystic intimations. In this case, the spiritual world remains unknown. The more one strives to continue this path of intimation, of mysticism, the more unknown becomes the spiritual world. In neither case do we enter the spiritual world. In one case, the illusion becomes greater. In the other, the ignorance becomes greater. In contrast with these two false ways, one must seek for the true way. If one would prepare oneself to find the true and genuine way to spiritually real knowledge, it is necessary to fix firmly in mind how impossible it is to pass from a knowledge of the illusion, in the sense used above, to a knowledge of the true self, or likewise from an intimation of the true self, from a mystical feeling of the true self, to a perception of the reality within the illusion. Let us consider once for all, without prejudgment, what really occurs. One can never, from a materialistic point of view, so highly honor all the modern natural scientific investigators, such as Darwin, Huxley, Spencer, and others, as can one who knows the spiritual world. For these men and many others since the time of Giordano Bruno have really done an endless amount of work in order to understand that which in all ages has been seen in the mysteries to be the great illusion. We do not need to hold the theories of Darwin, Huxley, Spencer, Copernicus, and Galileo. Let men think theoretically. What they will about the universe, we will have nothing to do with this, but we will simply clarify our minds as to the stimulation that these men have given toward the objective of seeing in detail, in a purely material way, into this or that organ in man, in the plant, in the animal, into this or that secret which holds sway in the stone. We must realize what has been discovered in our day as to life in glands, nerves, heart, brain, lungs, liver, through the stimulation imparted by this research. In this way we shall arrive at a rightful appreciation. But with all these details of knowledge, it is not possible to advance in the whole of actual life beyond a certain point. This I wish to illustrate to you in three examples. It is possible to learn with extraordinary precision how the human ovum takes form, how this germ little by little shapes itself into the human embryo, how one by one it produces organs, how little organs arranged along the periphery give rise finally to the wonderful system of heart and blood vessels. All this can be learned. It is possible to learn how wonderfully everything in the plant evolves in a material way from the roots up to the blossom and the seed. One can, in this manner, construct a whole world according to the conceptions one has formed, a world reaching even to the stars. This has actually been done by our astronomical and astrophysical theorists. They have constructed out of a system of stellar nebula a world that has attained to increasing definite structure, has been capable of evolving life out of itself, and so forth. All this can be constructed, but in the end, the thinker stands there and asks about his own being, as a man, about the solution that must be given to the problem, know thyself. And if he comes to a knowledge of that self, only which is embraced within what he knows in connection with stone, plant, animal, with the human organs, with the human glandular and circulatory systems, what, in that case, does he know? He knows the world that man enters at birth and leaves at death, nothing more. But in the depths of his own being, man feels that this is not his true and final boundary. And so, from the innermost center of his being, he must cry out in the presence of all the external knowledge that may come to him in such completeness and such splendor. All this thou takest upon thee only between birth and death. What art thou in thine own true being? At the very moment when the question of a knowledge of nature and of man takes a religious direction, at that very moment that capacity of man's which looks into the world of the great illusion comes to a standstill. The problem, know thyself, so that thou mayest know whence thou art in thine innermost being, whither thou goest in thine innermost being. This problem, the problem of knowledge applied religiously, remains unsolved. It was this that the ancient mysteries made clear to their disciples, even at their very portals. Thou mayest know what thou wilt through the external senses, yet when thy question takes a religious direction, then the great problem of man, the great human riddle, remains unsolved. Furthermore, we may be able to perceive with the utmost adequacy how the human countenance is formed. We may be able to perceive with the utmost adequacy how a man moves his arms and hands, how he walks and stands. We may attain the most delicate feeling for the form of an animal, the form of a plant, just so far as we can know this through our senses. Yet the very moment we would apply it, we would apply in an artistic manner this feeling of ours, what we have thus grasped, there remains for us once more an unanswered question. For how have men hitherto applied in the arts what they knew of the world? It was the mysteries that inspired them to this in ancient times. Men learned this or that about nature according to the powers of cognition then existent, but they deepened this knowledge by their perception of the spiritual. We need go back only to ancient Greece. When we observe today a painter, a sculptor, he looks for a model, at least such was still always the case until recently, though it is less so today. He looks for a model. He wishes to copy something. He wishes to imitate something. He looks for a model. This the Greeks did not do. It is wrongly supposed that the Greeks did this. The Greek felt the spiritual man within himself. If he wished, as a sculptor, to model an arm in its movement, he knew, in that which I see externally as a model, there the spiritual is concealed. He knew that everything material is created according to the spiritual, and he strove in his own creating to follow the spiritual. Even as late as the period of the Renaissance, the painter did not simply place himself before the model and look at this. This was only a stimulus to him. That which he knew from within as living in arm or hand, this he brought into movement. How man lives inwardly with the spirit, this he brought into his work. The mere external perception, within the great illusion, in Maya, the mere imitating of the model, leaves us standing where we are, not in man, but before man. If the question is applied to art, and if we remain within the great illusion, we face the great question of man, the mighty human riddles, without any answer. Again, it was at the portals of the ancient mysteries that the disciple who was to be initiated was made to know clearly, if thou wilt remain within the external world of illusion, thou canst not penetrate within the being of man, nor yet within the being of another kingdom of nature, thou canst not become an artist. On the path of art also the need was to set man face to face with the well-defined problem, know thyself. At that time the need for spiritual knowledge was realized. You will say, but there are entirely materialistic sculptors, materialistic painters, and these can also achieve somewhat. These know very well how to unlock the secrets of the model and work these into the forms they fashion, into the stuffs they use. To be sure. But whence have they this capacity? They do not of themselves know this. This is simply not perceived. They have learned it from the earlier painters, and these in turn from those still earlier. This is tradition. It is known how this was done by the earlier painters. Artists do not always say just this, because they themselves wish also to be talented, but they are not. It is simply known how the earliest of these early painters obtained the very secret itself through spiritual perceptions within the mysteries. Earlier painters, earlier sculptors, obtained it from the mysteries. Raphael, Michelangelo obtained it from these painters, who had received it in turn from the mysteries. But real art must be created out of the spiritual, otherwise it simply cannot be done. The moment we face man, our perception of the great illusion of Maya leaves unsolved the riddle of life, the riddle of man. If we wish to arrive again at the original in art, at creative art, here again we must possess a vision of the spiritual world. A third example. As a botanist, a zoologist, you may know in a wonderful way every plant form accessible to you. In physiological chemistry, you may describe the processes that occur within plants. You can learn the processes whereby nutriment is metamorphosed in the digestive organs and in the blood, and further on, even into the nerves. All this you can learn to know. You may become a very keen anatomist, or physiologist, or botanist, or zoologist, and investigate very much within the world of the great illusion. But if you wish to deal with man curatively, medicinally, by means of all these forms of knowledge, if you wish to find the path from the nature of man, even from the inner nature of man, to his being, this cannot be done. You will say, but there are plenty of materialistically minded physicians who desire to know nothing whatever of the spiritual world, who are guided only by what can be investigated by means of natural science, and yet they do perform cures. Yes, but why do they perform cures? They do so likewise because they have the tradition from an ancient world conception. Ancient medicines also were derived from the mysteries, but they all possess a remarkable characteristic. If you take up an ancient prescription, it is enormously complicated. Very much was required in order to produce it and to apply it to that to which one was told it should be applied, according to the ancient tradition. If you had entered one of the ancient mysteries and had asked a physician of the mysteries how such a prescription had come about, he would not have replied, "I make chemical researches. First I simply investigate whether the substances are related so and so to one another, and then I use this with the sick person and observe the effects." The physician of the mysteries would never have said this to you. It would not have occurred to him. Men simply do not know how this was in earlier times. He would have replied to you, "I live in the laboratory," if you wish to call it that, "which is conducted for me in accordance with the mysteries, and when I discover a medicine, it is the gods who have told me of it." For he was quite clear in his mind that through the whole mood generated in his laboratory, he was brought into living intercourse with the spiritual world. Spiritual beings became just as truly present for him there as under other circumstances men are present. He then became conscious of the fact that through the influence of spiritual beings in the spiritual world, he could be something more than without such an influence. Thus he mixed his complicated prescription. Not according to a knowledge of nature, but after a divine fashion, he mixed it. Within these very mysteries, men knew that if they wished to deal with man, they must not remain within the illusion. They must penetrate through to the truth of the divine world. Men are much further advanced today in their external knowledge than were the ancients with their mysteries. But the path must be rediscovered. For this is the third thing that I wished to set before you as an example. If a person is equipped with the most comprehensive knowledge of nature, that is, of the great illusion, and he wishes to produce cures, he stands again with unanswered questions in the presence of human life, of the human riddle. If he proceeds from the illusion to man, from the saying, "Nature is the great illusion," to the saying, "Know thyself," as this must be understood in healing also, he cannot advance a single step. Thus we may say, on the basis of these three examples, that a man who desires to throw a bridge across from the world of the great illusion, from Maya, to the "Know thyself," sees that he stands face to face with nothingness. If he takes the illusion as his point of departure, the moment he seeks to deal in religious feeling with the human being, or creatively as artist, or with healing as physician, he cannot do these things unless he passes over to an entirely different knowledge from the knowledge of external nature, the knowledge of the great illusion, of Maya. We shall now institute a comparison between the manner in which men sought in ancient times from the realm of the mysteries to develop a total knowledge of the world, and the manner in which men seek to do this today, in order that we may thereby get our bearings as to the path to such a total knowledge of the world. Utterly different was the way in which men spoke some thousands of years ago about the world and its being from the way in which those learned men speak today who claim to possess authority. Let us transport ourselves backward some thousands of years to the time when a brilliant, majestic knowledge flourished in Western Asia out of the sacred mysteries. Let us, through a few characteristic strokes, deepen our understanding of the character of that knowledge. At that time, something like the following was taught in ancient Chaldea. When a man directs the gaze of his soul, of his spirit, to the wonderful contrast between his life while asleep, parenthesis, consciousness is dulled, man knows nothing of his life, parenthesis, and the life that he leads when awake, parenthesis, all is luminous about the man, he knows of his own life, parenthesis, he then experiences the outermost boundaries of existence to which he can attain through the forces of his soul. Quite differently was this interchange between sleeping and waking felt thousands of years ago. Sleep was not so unconscious. The waking state was not so fully conscious. During sleep, men became aware of varying, mighty pictures, the weaving, flowing world life. While they slept, they were in the midst of the essentially real. The fact that sleep has become so unconscious is related to the evolution of man. On the other hand, some thousands of years ago, the waking state was not so bright, not so illuminated as it is today. Things did not possess firm outlines. They were blurred. There still flashed out of them all sorts of spiritual being. There was no such brusque transition between waking and sleeping. Yet men could distinguish the two states, and they called all that was experienced in the waking state something like apsu. That was the world of the waking state. The state in which a person was while asleep, the weaving, welling, that through which he could not so easily distinguish between mineral, plant, and animal as he could do when awake, this was called Tiamat. Tiamat. Now, in the Chaldean mysteries, it was taught that man is more fully within the true, within the real, while he sleeps and weaves in Tiamat, than while he lives in the waking state among the minerals, plants, and animals. That Tiamat is more primal, more united with the human undulation, than Apsu. That Apsu was more unknown, that Tiamat represented what lies close to man himself. But in the course of time, changes occurred in Tiamat. Thus were the disciples informed and taught in the mysteries. Out of the weaving and the life there arose demon forms, horse-like forms with human heads, lion-like forms with heads of angels. They arose out of the tissue of Tiamat. That which lived there in the forms of demons became hostile to man. But there entered the world then a mighty being, Ea. Whoever has a feeling today for sound, feels in the harmony of A and Ah, a reference to that mighty being who stood beside man as a helper in the sense of these ancient mystery teachings when the demons coming out of Tiamat were also mighty. Ea, Ea, which later, when the particle for existence was prefixed, became Sophia, Sophia, Ea. Approximately that which we indicate by the abstract term wisdom, the wisdom that rules in all things, Ea, the wisdom holding sway in all things, Sophia, Soph, is a particle that which denotes approximately the participle being, Sophia, 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 the ruling wisdom, the wisdom holding sway over all, sent to man a son, the son whom the men of that time named Marduk, whom we are accustomed to designate in a somewhat later terminology, Michael, as the ruling member of the hierarchy of archangels, Michael. This is the same being as Marduk, the son of Ea, wisdom. Marduk, Michael. And Marduk, Michael, such was the mystery teaching, was mighty, great, and powerful. And all those demon beings, such as horses with human heads, forms of lions with heads of angels, all those weaving, welling demons stood in their whole array, confronting him as the great Tiamat, He was mighty, Marduk Michael, to rule the storm wind which rushed through the world. All Tiamat, parenthesis, all this was represented as essentially real, and rightly so, for thus did men see it as real. Parenthesis, all these demons together formed a mighty dragon, which set himself forth raging like fire as the adversary, as the sum total of the demon powers which were born of Tiamat, of the night, as their being, raging like fire, encountered Marduk Michael, he first thrust other weapons into the demon, and then hurled into his vitals the whole power of the storm wind, and the being Tiamat burst asunder and rolled apart and scattered into all the world. Then Marduk Michael was able to form the heavens above and the earth below. Thus arose that which is above and that which is beneath. Thus were men taught in the mysteries. The great son of Ea, Wisdom, has mastered Tiamat, and has formed out of one part of Tiamat the heavens above, and out of another part of the earth beneath. Look, O man, up to the stars, and thou beholdest a part of that which Marduk Michael has formed above out of the terrible abysses of Tiamat for the healing of man. And if thou lookest beneath, where the plants grow out of the mineral-permeated earth, where the animals take on their forms, thou findest there another part of which the son of Ea, Wisdom, has transmuted out of Tiamat for the healing of man. Thus the humanity of that ancient time in old Chaldea looked back to a shaping process in the world, to something possessed of real being. All this was felt by man as real being. These demon forms that peopled the night, all that Marduk Michael formed out of the shapes of night, out of the mighty weaving beings that I have described to you, all that he formed as the heavens above and the earth below, all that shines upon us from the stars, all this was transformed demons, transformed by Marduk Michael. All that grows for us out of the earth itself, all this was hide transmuted by Marduk Michael, transformed tissue of Tiamat. So did man in ancient times look upon that which he could represent to himself through the ancient forces of the soul. This was knowledge. The leaders of the mysteries then prepared their disciples in complete secrecy, prepared them as to the powers of their souls. And when the disciples had evolved such powers of soul, they were then able to learn the first elements of what we give to school children as the earliest rudiments of such knowledge, that the sun is at rest and the earth revolves around it, that worlds have been formed out of nebula. This teaching concerning nature, such as we give today to school children, this was the great secret. On the other hand, that which was openly taught to everybody was what I have related to you concerning the deeds of Marduk Michael. Today we learn in our schools, although these have nothing of the mysteries in them, in our universities, but also even in the lower schools, all the way down to the elementary schools, what the Copernican world conception contains as astrophysical world knowledge. This the ancient sages had to attain and could attain only after long preparation. What every schoolboy knows today could be known in ancient times only when one had become an initiate. There was a time, this lies even further back than the wisdom of the ancient Chaldean mystery system, when men talked only of such things as I have described to you, of Ea, of Marduk Michael, of Apsu and Tiamat. Only of such things did those men speak. At that period they shrank from all of the things, as those whimsical mystery teachers said concerning the motions of the stars, the motion of the sun. They wished to inquire into that alone which presented itself to man, although in the more real form of ancient clairvoyance. Men scorned what was attained by the ancient initiate teachers and their disciples. Then came the time when the primeval wisdom out of the Orient was gradually made ready. At that time men prized both kinds of knowledge. They prized what they possessed in the very life of the essential being of the spiritual world, as this lived itself out. They prized, for example, what consisted of the deeds of the spiritual being Marduk Michael. They prized likewise what could be drawn on a blackboard, for instance, the sun in the midst, and round about it the stars moving in cycles and epicycles. Men prized all of this. Later came the time when man no longer possessed this capacity of seeing into the spiritual world, the worlds of gods and demons, the time when the other knowledge especially developed, the intellectual knowledge, that knowledge of which the present-day man is so proud, which has developed gradually to its culmination approximately in our own age. In the external world, we stand today approximately in that period in which man scorns the spiritual, just as the material was scorned in ancient times by those to whom the spiritual was self-evident. We must find our way vitally into times when we shall again be capable of receiving what spiritual knowledge gives in the form of essential spiritual content, together with what is taught by astronomers, astrophysicists, zoologists, and biologists. This time has arrived. Man must direct his life toward this time if he would perform his mission, if he would again attain to religious art, to the knowledge of healing, and so forth. Thus in ancient times the spiritual shone among men, but the material was scorned. And then came a time when man took up materialistic knowledge, which has now become great and has overwhelmed his spirituality. But just as man mistakenly lived in ancient times in the spiritual alone, and scorned the external world, and just as he has erroneously scorned the spiritual in the age when he prized the material, so must there now come a time when man shall return again from the comprehensive and wonderful knowledge of the external world to a new mystery knowledge. Now that materialistic knowledge, which has grown to be so wonderful, has torn away one fragment after another from the ancient spirituality, so that at length, like primeval structures, it has left no trace of itself upon the earth save the last residue, such as one unearths of ancient material structures, so we must now return again to a spirituality, but with a full knowledge of that which we can point out when we excavate, so to speak, in history as we look back to the earlier periods on earth. We must come again to such a spirituality through a new religiously deepened artistic molding, through a new knowledge of the spirit, a knowledge penetrating deep into the being of man, through a technique of healing. These are three examples that I have brought before you today, in order to build up again mysteries before which we shall stand as before something that can bring us to a knowledge of the total being of the world, and to a treatment of man for the healing of humanity in the sense of that totality, not merely the one-sided materialistic reality. The end of Lecture 1.